This podcast is brought to you by Sky Arts, proud broadcast sponsor of the Guardian Hay Festival, bringing you the book show at Hay every day at 7 p.m. on Sky Arts One HD with me, Mariella Frostrup. For details, visit sky.com/arts.
Hello, I'm PC 788 Gary Cole, Devon Powers Police, and I'm here policing the Hay Festival. Ex-President Musharraf's here tonight, so there's additional security, obviously, for the ex-president. I can't go into the exact details of the security here, but obviously we've got additional police officers here, and Mr. Musharraf is obviously his own security team looking after him.
There's a huge amount of bobbies here, like people that you can see are undercover, I guess, as well, so large men in suits. Well, even with Jimmy Carter a couple of years ago, it wasn't anywhere near this scale.
I think he's very brave to actually come and talk to us.
It's not something I've experienced before at Hay. I don't particularly like it. Are we really living under this huge terrorist threat in Hay on Wye? I actually don't believe that. I don't think so. So I think it's overdone.
I'd like to hear him reveal as to what his plans are, what he wants to do. He's got us into a mess.
I'm coming because I worked in Pakistan after the 2005 earthquake, and I'll be interested to see what his thoughts are about the disputed territories.
How a dictator wants to be a democrat. Because he was a dictator not so long ago, and he wants to stand up for democratic office.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you warmly for joining us on what I hope will be a most interesting evening, a conversation between Kerry Schofield and General Musharraf, who, of course, was President of Pakistan. This conversation takes place in the context...
There is no doubt in my mind that we have to defeat Al-Qaeda and Taliban, and we have to do it jointly together, because otherwise it will have an impact on the whole world. The center of gravity of all this, ladies and gentlemen, I am very clear, lies in Afghanistan and the tribal agencies of Pakistan. And I believe as a soldier, if you want to defeat an enemy, defeat his center of gravity. If you lose at the center of gravity, you lose everywhere on the periphery, with an impact on Europe and maybe in the mainland United States. So therefore, any talk of quitting, I think it's just not the option. Quitting is not an option. Obviously, when you go and try to stabilize politically, you have to have mass support of the people. And if I have to go back and I have the mass support of the people, that is the primary requirement. If you have that mass support and you can unify in thought and action, political forces, bureaucracy, and the military, I think you can take Pakistan back to the N11 situation. There's no doubt in my mind. And, well, I hope that I'm able to take all decisions in favor of Pakistan in the future also.
I thought it was very disappointing because the interviewer was very weak. It was really just gave him a political platform to speak, which I thought was a terrible shame.
It was wonderful.
Good speaker, but I'm not sure he's that sincere man that he says he is.
I thought he focused very much on fighting and not at all on peace. I thought he used the language of Bush, and he didn't talk at all about how the political elite would engage with the masses, which are, they live in completely different planets.
Well, it was very sort of politician-like. He didn't sort of, he was very quite guarded. He gave a sort of impression that he just wanted to return to Pakistani politics and to a certain extent try and carry on from where he left off. He came across as being very, very balanced and very measured in what he was saying.
Now, Pervez Musharraf isn't the only controversial figure at the Hay Festival this year. I'm sure Christopher Hitchens would bridle at being compared to the former Pakistani leader, but they do share an ability to divide opinion. Christopher's here this year to launch his memoir, Hitch 22. It's a memoir of confessions and contradictions. I'm David Shariat-Madari from Commenters Free, and I'm here in the Guardian's luxury shed to talk to Christopher Hitchens. Now, Christopher, in some ways, Pervez Musharraf embodies the kind of illegitimate ruler you've spent your life railing against. But he was, of course, seen as a valuable ally of the US after 9/11. Was support for his regime a price worth paying, do you think?
Talibanization is another name for the colonization of Afghanistan by Pakistan. The best thing that President Bush did, one of the many good things he did in response to September 11, 2001, was to shift American policy away from its Cold War base of hostility to India and towards a more open engagement with it. I still think any policy in the region not based on friendship with India, a huge secular, multi-ethnic, English-speaking democracy, is doomed to fail.
Okay, let's turn to your memoir. Now, there's a clear sense of a young man developing, a sense of destiny almost, that runs through the book. But, of course, life isn't always neat and tidy like that. So I wanted to know, in the process of writing it, how much did you polish, gloss over, or improve for public consumption?
Well, I left a lot out, would be the first thing I would want to say. I mean, there were things that I realised I just wouldn't have room for. As it was, I wrote more than twice as much as the publisher had asked for. And with life writing, there is the problem that whereas one usually practices economy, in writing a memoir, your memory actually improves. It would be for someone else who knew me, I think, at the time, or had known me, to say whether I'd polished, euphemized, you know, gilded the lily in any way.
I think a lot of people would be quite shocked to read about your mother's suicide and the circumstances of it. So is it something you've made a decision not to talk about very much up until now?
Very much so. I mean, for a long time I suspected myself, even if I told a close friend about it, because I was afraid of looking as if I was in search of sympathy. But I remember thinking that I would one day have to write about it. And so when I was asked to consider writing a memoir, I first thought that if I can write the chapter about Yvonne, my mother, in such a way that it is, I hope, moving, but without being sentimental, then I think I could probably do the rest. So I wrote it all in one go. I wrote it in one evening, having thought about it for quite a while. And then I cried more than I thought I would, but I didn't think it would make anyone else cry. I didn't want it to have that effect. I sent it to my publisher and my agent, and I said, if this works, then I think I can do it, and if you don't like it, we'll drop the whole subject.
One thing that struck me about the scene where you go to Athens and you see the room where your mother died is that you move quite seamlessly to a consideration of the political scene, because obviously Athens is kind of in tumult at the time. And I wondered if there was a sense in which you were taking refuge slightly in the political side of things, and whether that's something that you've seen as a pattern in your life, because obviously you're a very politically engaged person.
Not, I wouldn't say I normally took refuge in politics. No, it's not much. People who are in search of refuge probably shouldn't go into politics, especially the politics of war and revolution that interest me the most. But I certainly took refuge in politics that week, I suppose you could say. I mean, if it had just been an average week in the winter in Athens and I'd had to be dealing with the Greek bureaucracy and trying to find out that my mother hadn't in fact been murdered but that had taken her own life with a lover in a suicide pact, that would have been a drama of a sort, but it would have been very bleak indeed. It was not made any less bleak by the fact that there was a revolution and a counter-revolution going on in the streets outside, that I was already friends with the Greek opposition to the dictatorship. I already knew something about it. I won't say it gave me something to do, but what it did mean was that the memory of that week can never leave me. It was too rich for my blood. That's why I think why it took me so long to try and write it down.
You use this interesting phrase quite a lot about keeping two sets of books. And I think that first comes up, well, it first comes up at school in chapel, but also at Oxford, where you're Chris on the one hand and you're Christopher on the other, and Chris is the agitator and Christopher is the person who goes for dinner with the Warden of All Souls. Mm-hmm. Do you still have a sense in your life now that you're keeping two sets of books? And is that magnified by being a public persona?
Yes, it is. Scott Fitzgerald says somewhere that the real sort of test of everybody is how they handle contradiction. Well, one way of handling contradiction is to admit it. In fact, that's step one. A lot of people try and act as if their beliefs, their behaviour, their allegiances and so on are, as it were, seamless. You won't, in fact, find that this is true of anybody. So The question is really acknowledging to yourself that you want more than one kind of life and seeing if you can get it without being hypocritical or without the one betraying the other. So it's my account of trying to do that.
Now, in Saturday's Haycast, your brother Peter talked to Madeleine Bunting about his book, The Rage Against God, and why atheism troubles him. Peter told Madeleine that he would like to hear your response to his book.
I had hoped that someone would have the wit to ask him to review it, and then we might have seen his response. He said he would respond at the time, but he expected to be asked to review it. So he never has actually given me the response he promised.
So you're actually quite keen for that dialogue.
Well, as soon as he said, I expect to be asked to do this, I thought, yeah, well, quite, would be a reasonable thing to do.
Right, do you want to know what I want to say? Well, it's very good indeed. I don't consider it to be a defence of religion, nor much of a critique of atheism, but it's a very good account of not just what Peter thinks, but of how.
Does it strike you as odd that you and your brother have become, this funny phrase, public intellectuals?
It is funny, isn't it?
Do you think you've spurred each other on?
I don't think so, no.
But you were the older brother,
yes.
So he would have seen you becoming a journalist, and perhaps that would have nudged
yes,
him.
Yes, but if anyone was ever definitely born to be a journalist, it would be Peter.
Why do you say that?
Oh, well, you could tell from the first. He got a typewriter long before I did, for example, and sort of taught himself to type. And we used to sort of produce family newspapers a bit, but I think he was usually the editor. And
yet you've ended up on...
We are very different politically, but there is one thing above all that creates a distance between me and anybody else, and it's simply the belief in the supernatural. I mean, it could be a failure of imagination on my part. If it weren't there, there's no question I feel a sense of loss.
At the Guardian debate last night, the motion of which was reason is always right, Ayaan Hirsi Ali was arguing for the motion, and she said, if I had a magic wand, I'd wave it and everyone here would become rational humanists. But you're saying that would take a bit of the variety out of life and...
Yes, and something
else, be left
and something,
with anyone to
and something unquantifiable as well. Yes, it would.
Okay, so there are some redeeming aspects to religion after all.
Sure, I've been to Esfahan.
Christopher Hitchens, thanks very much for talking to us about your memoir.
It's a pleasure, thank you.
I'm Nadine Gordimer, and the book that began to change my life was a translation into English of Marcel Proust's great novel, In Search of Lost Time. It made me realise that love wasn't what I thought it was in my little small town, that you grew up and you met a boy and you got married and had children, that it was much more complicated than that.
I'm here with Bill Bryson at the Hay Festival's premier cafe, Ascaris. And I've brought Bill here because his new book, At Home, is all about household objects, things we take for granted. So we've an array of tables in front of us where festival goers are happily munching their lunch, and on each is a pair of salt and pepper shakers. And Bill, can you tell us the story behind these?
Salt is very easy to tell, because we have salt on the table because we need it. I mean, salt is extremely vital to us. And the interesting thing about salt is that you don't feel a craving for it. If you have it, if it's taken out of your diet, which is extremely unlikely because it's in everything, it's in the bread you eat, it's in everything, but if it was suddenly missing from your diet, you would start to feel unwell and you would almost certainly do things to go and get it. You would start eating odd foods without knowing why you were doing it. You would just instinctively go looking for salt. But because you have no craving for salt, you wouldn't know why you were doing that. And people in history have done that. I mean, they've gone to the most extraordinary lengths to get salt back in their diet. Because it's such a vital thing that you have to have it. Otherwise, your cells would just shut down. They wouldn't function. So you actually need salt. So salt is easily told. Pepper is a much, much more complicated story. It's just one of those spices that was the kind of the heart of the great age of discovery. But the point I make in the book is that all those people like Christopher Columbus and Vasco da Gama and all of those people that we read about in school as the great adventurers, you kind of forget that they weren't really setting off to find new lands or to, conquer the world or anything. They were looking for spices. And for at least 100 years, spices were not just the most valuable foodstuffs they were the most valuable commodities of any kind on Earth.
Okay, so we've covered salt and pepper. Let's move from the tables to the counter and order a cup of tea. Bill, what would you like, tea or coffee?
Or could I have tea, please?
Hi, could we get two cups of tea, please?
Yes, certainly. What sort would you like?
Just English breakfast is fine.
One moment.
Tea is the whole explanation of the British Empire. Fundamentally, what the reason you have had India and the reason you went looking for that kind of thing was in order to get tea onto British tables. People had a great passion for tea. Tea and sugar were two big things that people just loved in the 18th century.
Something very interesting, a really nice detail that I like from the book was this idea that when sugar was very rare and it turned your teeth black, people would eat it so much that it would turn their teeth black. But then if they didn't get black teeth, they'd blacken them anyway to show how wealthy
yes,
they were.
Yes, it was very fashionable to make your teeth look rotten. So because that was a way of demonstrating that you were able to get a lot of sugar into your diet. And for when sugar was new, I mean, you can imagine, people have never had sugar before. All they've been able to do is sweeten things with honey and sort of stuff like that, which is fairly inadequate way of getting a lot of sweetness in your life. So suddenly they're confronted with this glorious, must have been practically hallucinogenic product, which makes things very, very sweet, and they just put it on everything. I mean, they put it on eggs, they put it on meat, they put it in their drinks, in their wine, and everything. People couldn't get enough sugar.
Well, obviously, we're in a dining room here, but your book takes in every room in the house. Which was the most interesting one, do you think? Which revealed the most unusual things?
Every one of them was huge, and some of them were just they were just kind of preposterously huge, because our kitchen was going to be cooking, and once you start looking at the history of cooking, you easily spend the rest of my life just doing that. So the real problem with the book wasn't gathering material, it was keeping material out. It was deciding what not to use. I mean, I have never generated so much over matter with the book as I did with this one.
Okay, let's move along the counter to where the cutlery is kept and talk about the fork. So here we have a fork. Can you tell us the story of the fork?
A guy named Thomas Coriate, an Englishman who did a lot of travelling abroad, he introduced the dining fork into British life in the 1600s. Before that, forks were just like pitchforks. I mean, they were like farm implements. And then they became two-pronged things that were used to sort of hold down birds and things when you were carving. But the idea of having a fork as something that you put your food on and hefted the food into your mouth with was looked at as this really kind of very unmanly, very sort of effeminate thing. And so for that reason, people pronged bits of meat with their knife and just fed it in that way.
It's interesting you talking about the way in which the meaning of the word fork changed from farmyard implement to something we eat our food with, because words come up a lot in this book. Etymology seems to be a real interest of yours. Why is it that words draw you in so much?
Well, partly because I say that there's still a lot of things we don't know anything about. And for me, trying to find out this stuff, researching into this stuff, You keep coming to dead ends where the books just don't give you this information. And one of the little devices I learned just out of necessity was a good place to start looking for the history of anything is the Oxford English Dictionary. If you just look at fork, it'll tell you, until such and such a year, it was primarily used to describe, farmyard implements. But you can do that with any word.
In the course of your writing, you've covered, I think, four different continents, linguistics, Shakespeare, the universe, and now you've written a book about houses and what's in them, which takes in everything from the first recorded houses in the Orkney Islands right up to a 19th century recipe for a mixture to get rid of freckles. Is there anything you're not interested in?
Well, there's plenty that I I'm not interested in or I'm not capable of following up professionally, but there's nothing, I think, that doesn't have a lot of potential for learning and excitement in it.
You're listening to the Guardian Hay cast. My name's Ian McKeown. The best opening line I've ever read is from Albert Camus, L'Étranger, in which he says something like, "My mother died yesterday, or was it the day before?" And I was thinking, what a wonderful account of a displaced consciousness that is, because you're meant to remember when your mother died. The Guardian's Hearcast with Claire Armistead and Sarah Crown.
So, Sarah, we heard Musharraf at the top of the programme. He was the big news today, but what else has been going on?
Well, we've had a number of really interesting events last night and this morning. And Grayson Perry last night was very, very popular, as acerbic as ever. Everyone came out of that laughing. Then we also had this morning Thomas Bergenthal, who's the Hague judge, on his experience as a child in Auschwitz, which apparently was incredibly moving
pin drop sort of territory.
I know Ian Katz took his 11-year-old and said it was the most impressive paid-for event he'd ever been to, and seeing the recognition on his 11-year-old's face dawn that this was somebody talking about them at the same age, having been in Auschwitz.
Which is a real testament, really. I expect everyone will be in the bookshop buying his book now. The political programme has also moved on since yesterday. We've got the Education Secretary, Michael Gove, has just suddenly appeared in the programme again with the Guardian's deputy editor, Ian Katz, who'll be speaking to him this afternoon, so that's a new addition to the programme this afternoon. But actually, the best event for me so far, the best one that I caught, was with the Booker winner, Roddy Doyle, who was here talking about the last novel in his Henry Smart trilogy. And it ended up being just easily one of the most entertaining sessions I've been to in my sort of history of Hay.
Why is it that the Irish get away with swearing in literature and music?
I haven't a fucking clue, to be honest. It's one of the mysteries. I say it and people laugh and applaud. I don't know if somebody Nigerian said it. I don't know. There'd be shock. I don't know. It's in the rhythm. It's in the air, really. And the fight of parents to try and kill it off and to try and make it respectable, I think... There are those of us who learn the subtlety of language and the words that you do and you don't use, you know, and the occasions when you use them. And that's, I think, what a good education should always be about, when and when not. And I think I was well taught in that regard, at home more, not in school. I think one of the reasons why we glory in profanity in the English language is because the Irish language is compulsory. And you would have thought that after 40 minutes every day, from age 5 to 18, that I'd have some sort of proficiency in the Irish language. But I didn't, and the reason being largely because we were never taught to be crude, you know. So it could never live in our lives, because you have to be crude. You know, if you're 16 and you're with a bunch of 16-year-olds, you have to be crude. It's part of the freedom of growing older, you know. And I hear my children using it. I occasionally become the father and say, like, and I have on a, would you for fuck's sake stop that? And I hope, and I think they're learning the subtlety of it as well. So I just think it's in the air. And that's at a risk of sounding a bit sentimental.
Although I should point out that in the rest of the session, he wasn't being sentimental at all. But Claire, I know that one of the sessions that caught your eye was with Alan de Botton and Jerry Hall, which seemed like a very odd combination.
Yeah, it's about as odd as you can get, isn't it, really? A supermodel and a philosopher discussing self-help books.
That's kind of like self-help kind of talk, isn't it? You know, if you feel anger about something, it's because you have that fault or something.
Well, it's interesting that you mention self-help because, you know, we're at Hay on Wye, highbrow, elite literary festival. And I would say that if we said to the audience, you know, so, you know, how many of you are regular readers of self-help books? There would be a general embarrassed silence. There is no more low genre in our society than the self-help book. It's beneath comics, it's beneath pornography, it's beneath, you know, pretty much anything. And when people want to be really mean to me, they say, oh, he's a writer of self-help books. We've really put him in his place. Now, why is that? I think self-help books are an extremely fascinating genre. What is a self-help book? A self-help book is a book that you read that helps you. Now, if we take that ambition suitably seriously, that includes, you know, Anna Karenina, you know, the letters of Seneca, the essays of Montaigne, and, you know, the poems of W.A. Jordan. They are all self-help books. And so, you know, bring them on. I like the self-help books. They're a good thing. The problem with self-help books is we have a very narrow definition of them. They have to have pink covers. They have to sell you a very optimistic message. There has to be an answer to every problem, etc., which gives the genre a bad name. But I think that the idea of reading a book that makes you feel better is a great one.
Well, it's been the most fabulous weather here, Sarah, but you haven't actually seen any of it, have you? Because you've been stuck in the porter cabin editing the website.
Yes, we've got lots and lots of new things on the website today. The first of the Commenters Free videos has gone up with John Crudas. We've got a gallery of photographs of Hay in the Rain to show that it hasn't been sunny the whole time that we've been here. And we have the latest news and blogs and tweets. If you prefer to follow it in 140 characters, go and visit all of this on the website at guardian.co.uk/hay. Tracy here, you might remember me from yesterday. I'm the festival goer who spent £500 with her husband on tickets. So far, our ticket sales have only cost us £4 or £5 each time, which is, I think, is real great value for money. I've put a bit of a league table together of what I think has been really good. Now, my surprising
ticket value for money was Nigel Mansell, who I thought was going to be very boring, but he was talking about his UK youth cycle ride around the UK. That was only £5, I think. That was only a £5. My real value for money for the best so far, and again a £5, was Christopher Lloyd. And he was talking about What on Earth Evolved. It's a book about 100 different species. He had a train set on the stage. He had objects on the stage. He got people up out of the audience. He spoke for 50 minutes, and it was enthralling. It was absolutely fantastic. And I'd never heard of him before, which is great. That's what you come here for. Probably the best speaker I've been to so far was Howard Davis. But then he's a LSE lecturer, so you expect to be good. He actually was speaking and put humour in it as well. He talked about the economy coming back from the brink. He rated it in a film show and sort of made it a bit normal as well. But then, so far, I've only been to highbrow talks. Later in the week, I'm going to be going to fiction writers, and it's going to be interesting to see whether or not I'm going to enjoy them as much as some of these highbrow things I've been to, which have really been mind-stimulating. That's it from us for today. Claire, what are you up to tonight?
Well, I'm going to be going to the Guardian Book Club, in which John Mullen is talking to David Mitchell about Cloud Atlas.
And he's one of the Hay stars this year, isn't he?
Absolutely. No, of course, he's got his new novel out, and we're very interested to know how you pronounce the title.
Yes.
Please don't ask me to do it. A bit of speculation.
And to end today's Haycast, let's have a bit of music from one of the Hay evening sessions, which happened earlier on in the week. This is Alex Valentine.
Kiss my mouth, blow a hole in the sky, let the sun come out. Lift me up so I can shout. Shut up, kiss my mouth. Shut up and kiss my face, it's the only trip that I can't resist. If my heart's gonna tear, let it rip. Enough, shut up, kiss my lips. So keep on coming, yeah, keep on coming now. You make me feel like the first day of summer, and you know I love it, girl, you know I love it, and my heart is beating like a speed freak drumming now. Ah, shut up. Shut up and kiss my face. Let's do it in style. Let's celebrate all through the night and every day. Shut up and kiss my face. So keep on coming, yeah, keep on coming now. You make me feel like the first day of summer, and you know I love it, girl, you know I love it, and my heart is beating like a speed freak drumming now. Oh, shut up. Shut up and kiss my shut up, shut up. I want you so much. I predict that our lips are gonna touch.